Hey, it's John Engle, and I'm excited to share that registration is now live for Grid Tech Connect Forum California. Join us in Newport Beach, June 24th through the 26th for the Interconnection event. We're bringing together utilities, developers, regulators, and advocates to take on one of the biggest challenges facing the energy transition, both at the DG and utility scale levels. Click the link in the episode description and use promo code PODCAST to save 10% on admission. Join our partners from the Department of Energy, NREL, Southern California Edison, PG&E, CAISO, Sunrun, NG, Convergent, AES, and so many more for this impactful event. We'll see you there.
Am I excited? Yes, I am, because there's a massive need for what we do. Is it going to be hard? Absolutely. It's been ridiculously hard so far, and we don't expect it to be easy, but we've got to get on with it if we're going to actually decarbonize these hard-to-abate sectors.
Concentrated solar power has had a rough go in the U.S., but that's not because it's a poor resource. Using mirrors and towers, CSP can cleanly generate electricity, provide long-duration thermal energy storage, and decarbonize heavy industry by producing heat. Still, solar PV deployment in the U.S. dwarfs installed CSP capacity, 113 gigawatts to 2. Why hasn't it caught on here? I'm John Engle, Content Director for Renewable Energy World. This week on Factor This, we're bringing you something a little different. I'm joined by Craig Wood, CEO of the Australian next-gen CSP company Vast, which thinks it can change CSP's fortunes in the U.S. Vast is planning to list on the New York Stock Exchange at a valuation of more than $500 million to deploy its next-gen CSP technology. Wood breaks down CSP's less-than-sunny history, why it's getting a fresh look, and its role in the energy transition. That's all next on Factor This from Renewable Energy World. Well, Craig Wood, thanks for joining the Factor This podcast. Nice to see you.
Thanks very much for having me on, John. Great to see you too.
Well, since I started this podcast, it's been almost a year, coming up next month. I've been looking for an opportunity to take this deep dive into concentrated solar power for a number of reasons, but just haven't found the opportunity. You know, even though CSP has had that rocky past here in the U.S., there is a subtle undercurrent of interest here with the Department of Energy investing, you know, millions of dollars to research and companies like yours taking a fresh look at the technology. So I think it's a great time to be having this conversation. Craig, can you start off by telling us a little bit about yourself and how you ended up in this world of next gen CSP before we get to the tech?
Yeah, sure, John. So look, I started out life as a mechanical engineer. You might be able to tell from my accent that my original training was in Australia. Subsequent to finishing college, first go around, I ended up studying a little more in the US, sorry, in the UK, I should say, and then used that opportunity to transition into a brief banking career with a firm called Lehman Brothers that you might have heard of. I left there before all of the excitement and actually moved back to Australia and spent about...
It's a good disclaimer to prime the conversation.
I spent about a decade in private equity back here in Australia before moving into executive roles. I left the private equity firm I was working with to go fix up a dairy business that we'd bought. And then, through various connections, was introduced to Vast Solar about 7.5 years ago. And I've been the CEO of that business ever since.
And so we'll get into more of that unique approach that Vast is taking to CSP in just a minute and the New York Stock Exchange listing that you guys are working on and what you think about the U.S. market. But can you give us an overview of the evolution of CSP just to lay some foundation here on kind of these multiple stages that we've gone through, not just in the U.S., but globally, and where that kind of puts us in position today?
Sure. So look, at its core, what you're doing with CSP is you're using mirrors to concentrate and capture the sun's energy in the form of heat. And then in most CSP systems, you take that heat and you store it in what amounts to a giant thermal battery. And that's really important because it gives you dispatchability so that whenever you need the energy, either in the form of process heat, which is extremely efficient, or in the form of electricity, which is less efficient, you've got that ability to provide it when you need it. The technology itself, CSP broadly, has been through a number of iterations as it's matured. So most of those iterations really depend on the configuration of the mirrors that we use to capture the solar energy. The most popular and widely deployed technology at the moment is called parabolic trough technology. As the name suggests, it uses a series of linear collectors that are shaped like a parabola, and they focus the sun's energy onto a line That line has at its focal point a solar receiver that's full of thermal oil. The thermal oil, those systems, as I said, the most widely deployed, the thermal oil does have limitations, though. It can only go up to about 400 Celsius. And so by the time you've taken that energy at 400 Celsius, passed it into the storage medium, which is typically molten salt, and then use that heat ultimately to create steam to spin an electric turbine, you end up with a power cycle that's operating at between 330 and 350 Celsius. And that's a relatively inefficient power cycle. So the big limitation with the trough systems, you know, there's 6.5 gigawatts of them globally, but the big challenge with them is just that the energy is too expensive because of that power cycle limitation. So that we call that generation one technology. As I said, it's bankable, it's widely deployed. Now, a significant proportion, for example, of Spain's overnight energy comes from parabolic trough systems, but they're just expensive, and that's why they've been limited in their deployment. Generation two technology, they're called central tower systems. As the name suggests, it's one great big central tower, typically about 750 feet tall. And around that tower, there's then a whole series of what are called heliostats, which are basically curved mirrors that focus the sun, and they track the sun in two directions, azimuth and elevation. Those systems, CSP version 2, are now reasonably widely deployed. There are several examples in the US, Morocco, the most recent one being turned on in Dubai, Chile, China. So there's numerous examples of these systems all around the world. The advantage of the system, of the central tower system, is that it uses molten salt, both as the storage medium, but also as the medium that collects the heat. So they pump the salt up the tower and make it hot using the concentrated sunlight. Theoretically, that gives you a couple of big advantages. Number one, it allows you to go to the high temperatures because the salt can operate up to 600 Celsius, which means that by the time it's been in through storage and then turned into a power cycle, you can run a steam turbine at 538 Celsius, which is the normal steam turbine operating temperature. The other advantage, theoretically, is that you've got only two fluids, salt and steam, instead of three. So there's an argument that it could be cheaper. In practice, those systems have had some really quite significant challenges. Ultimately, there's a sort of technical challenge, and then there's a scale-driven economic challenge as well. In terms of the technical challenge, the issue has been the thermal control. So the ability of the system to absorb transients, normal people call them clouds, but if you're a CSP person, you call them transients. The ability of those systems to absorb the changes in the solar flux that are really quite significant, it's really not been adequate. And what that has meant is that you've got fluctuations in the salt temperature that are hitting the downstream equipment and causing failures. So that's been the major challenge that technology's faced. Even if that technology challenge is overcome, there's still a fundamental scale limitation. And that's because, in simple terms, you've got a tower that's 750 feet tall and you've got a mirror that's up to a mile away from the base of the tower. And it just doesn't make sense to put the next mirror a mile and a bit away because you don't ever make the amount of energy back that it costs you to install that mirror. So there's a fundamental scale limitation. By contrast, modular systems such as parabolic trough have an ability to simply stack more and more and more glass around a central power block. And then they use a fluid in the case of the central towers, in the case of parabolic troughs, I should say, the thermal oil. They use that fluid to move the energy to the central power block. And so you can build much bigger plants. And in CSP, that's how you drive the cost down.
But in the parabolic troughs, you're dealing with the lower temperatures, right? So that's the disadvantage there?
Correct. So, you know, if you go and look at parabolic trough systems, again, using that Dubai plant as an example, there's one central tower that's been built, which is a 100-megawatt turbine, but there are three parabolic trough systems that have been built around that tower, and those systems are 200-megawatt turbines. That just gives you a sense as to the scalability that modularity delivers.
And I think when a lot of people not connected to CSP at all picture the tall tower that you're describing, the 750-foot tower, how does that compare to the global capacity? Like, what's the split between the towers and the heliostats versus the parabolic troughs? Do you happen to know how that shakes out?
I'll give you a sense of it. There's probably 500 megawatts to a gigawatt of central tower installations around the world, ex-China. And there's 6.5 gigawatts of parabolic trough systems. What's happened over time, the troughs were all the vogue about 15 years ago. The last 10 years or so, people have been working on the central tower systems. And so it's kind of a technology shift that's happened, albeit the towers do have those limitations I talked about.
So again, before we get into the technology that you're working on, because I think it is super interesting and why you are targeting the US and wanting to list on a public market exchange here, that's all super interesting. Let's talk about how we got here in the evolution of the US market, because I know this is successful in a lot of global markets, but it's had a tougher go in the US. I think that, yeah, in the setup, I said the comparison in capacity with PV is something like 113 gigawatts to two. So there was a clear split when both of these technologies were coming on the scene. What happened here in the US and why have there been some struggles?
Hey, Factor This listeners, it's John Engel. I wanted to let you know that you can now watch every new episode of the Factor This podcast on YouTube. Just search Renewable Energy World and leave a rating and review while you're there. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, I mean, the US is a market that's not dissimilar to a bunch of other markets around the world, and it's really to do with the cost of the technology. So, you know, if you go back 30, 40 years, PV wasn't even a thing. So some of the earliest solar technology was actually concentrating solar, and some of those plants are actually built and still operating in the US today. If you go back maybe 15 years, PV by then was a thing, and there was a pretty robust debate as to whether CSP or PV was going to be the technology that was the bulk solar technology. If you go back 10 years, maybe even as recently as 7 years, that's when it became very clear to observers that PV was going to win the race. And the simple reason for that is that it's really cheap. You know, there was an investment made initially by the Germans, the Americans, and then in due course, the Chinese of, you know, call it $75 billion into the supply chain. And that means that we're now able to purchase incredibly cheap PV panels that are made in factories. They're installed by relatively unskilled labor in large deployments. And, you know, it's able to be done on rooftops as well, industrial as well as households. So there's a whole series of reasons why at the manufacturing level as well as the installation level, PV is cheap. So that's the reason, John, it simply won the race. The interesting thing and the reason why I'm sitting here and others like me who've continued to see the value in CSP keep getting out of bed every day is that we have this thing in the world called nighttime. And, you know, PV is great for the daytime. If you've got some batteries nearby, it's excellent for, you know, 1 to 2 to 4 hours when it's coupled with those batteries. But nighttime lasts for half the year. And it's important that there be dispatchable renewable technologies that can be turned on and off to complement the intermittent technologies like PV and wind. But we need that long duration storage element so that we can actually create reliable power grids that have got very high levels of decarbonisation.
And when it comes to the economics of operation, is the benefit more weighted to the long duration storage and industrial heat applications versus electricity generation, which you said was less efficient? Is that typically what we see most of the projects that are in operation, at least today, dedicated to?
Yes and no, John. So let me maybe just back up a second. So once I've got the heat in the tank, it's actually very, very efficient for me to use that heat in the form of heat. So it's like 95% plus efficient to take that and use that in some form of industrial process. By contrast, if I want to create electricity, I have to take that heat, use it to create steam, which is pretty efficient, but then I have to spin a turbine. And standard Rankine cycle turbines are only about 45% efficient. So in choosing to make electricity, I throw half of my hard-won energy away. If you think about electricity generation, it's really only utility-scale plants where CSP makes sense. And that's because you've got a big turbine, big salt tanks, you know, a big workforce to operate the turbine. And it really does push you towards significant scale applications. So what we have seen in the history of the industry is that people have gravitated towards utility scale electricity because it's able to be project financed. People are willing to make commitments for 30 years to buy that energy. CSP has been used historically in process heat as well, but it tends to be at a smaller level of applicability. So most industrial process heat operations don't need massive amounts of heat because they're able to historically burn gas to provide that heat. And so you've seen some limited applications. Typically, it's been, you know, people either exploring decarbonisation or it's been situations where the gas that they would otherwise be burning has been really expensive. And so it's made sense to put some solar stuff in there. But yeah, historically, because those process heat processes tend to be brownfield, they tend to be smaller, you tend to be competing against gas, which is pretty cheap because it's pretty good at doing the job of providing heat. Those projects have not been as economic as the utility scale electricity stuff.
So what does next gen mean to Vast? What are you doing differently? And what do you see in the US market specifically? You mentioned you're in the process of listing on the New York Stock Exchange. That would value the company somewhere shy of $600 million, but $500 million. Why here?
John, let me just talk a little bit about our technology for a moment and maybe how it's different, because ultimately it's the economics of our technology that we think open up the US market. Look, what we've done with our technology is taken a step back and said the parabolic trough systems, they're modular, which is critical. They're repeatable. Because they're modular, they're very controllable. But they had this problem with the thermal oil creating that limitation around efficiency. So we like that modularity concept, but we've got to move to something else that allows us to go to higher temperatures. So how do you do that? Well, if you go and look at generation two, the central towers, that tower concept is important because it allows you to get all the energy to one place. And the move to salt as a fluid is important because it allows you to push to the higher temperatures. So what we did about a touch over 10 years ago was actually go back to the textbooks and say, right, if we wanted to create a mixture of those two systems, a modular system that used the tower morphology, how would we do something different that allowed us to link those towers up with a fluid that wasn't salt? And the reason you can't use salt for that job is that salt is an excellent insulator. So if you have salt that you're pushing out through a distributed system and you have a problem, the best way to cover, we joke inside our business, but we say the best way to recover from a molten salt freeze is to cut the pipe out and weld in a new section. That's probably slight hyperbole, but you get the picture. When you go and look at the history of fluids and what people use for for thermal conduction in industry, there's a standout candidate, which is liquid sodium metal. Sodium's been used in the nuclear game for 7 decades as a coolant for nuclear reactors. So there's an extensive literature on how to do this, obviously in an industry that's got far higher intrinsic risk than what we do. So what we've essentially done is borrowed a bunch of that knowledge from the nuclear industry and applied that specifically in concentrating solar. So, and that's the big difference. Our system uses liquid sodium metal instead of thermal oil. That allows us to move to a modular tower system. And then we take that energy from the sodium that we've gathered by passing it through those towers. We put that into salt in the same way that others have done. And then when we need to, we take the heat out of the salt, create steam and spin a turbine, or we use it to create process heat. So we've got the best of both worlds. That's the guts of what our system does.
So you said you've been working on it for something like 10 years. So does it work? Have you deployed the technology and what have you seen from the results of whatever testing and demonstrating that you've done?
Yeah, so look, Vast has been in business for about 13 years. The first 5 years we spent working on components of the technology. The next 5 years we spent developing what we call a demonstration plant, which was a 1.1 megawatt grid-connected facility that's located about 5 hours west of Sydney. So to your question, yes. Have we built it and operated it? Absolutely we have. That plant connected to the grid in its final form in January of 2018, and we ran that plant for 32 months through until its scheduled decommissioning in October of 2020. I can't overestimate the importance of having done that to our business and to the technology. It's only by actually building stuff, running it, breaking it, fixing it, improving it, that you actually get to the point where you've got confidence, both in the technology, but also in the ability to operate the technology. That was, particularly an area of concern around the sodium, because, for your listeners who remember their year 9 chemistry class, if you put sodium in water, you can get some exciting reactions courtesy of the hydrogen that's generated going pop. So it's important that you actually demonstrate to everyone, to investors, to financiers, to the authorities, that you can operate the system safely and effectively. And that's what we did. So, are we confident that technology works? Yes, we are. Really the challenge for us as a business is to build the first utility scale demonstration of that technology, which we're doing in Port Augusta here in Australia. And then after that, the nice thing about a modular system is that it's actually very easy to scale. It's just doing more of the same, and in our case, linking that together with slightly larger sodium piping. So that's why we've got confidence that the business is ready to scale.
What's the status of that utility scale project? When do you start construction? When does that come online? What's kind of the timeline?
Yeah, so timeline is that we're looking to reach final investment decision at the end of this calendar year. Importantly, you know, if you look at the ingredients you need to build one of these big utility scale projects, the most important one is money.
You don't say.
we made some good progress on that in recent months. The Australian government through ARENA, which is the Australian Renewable Energy Agency, has confirmed that they'll provide up to $65 million of grant funding for that project. And that funding sits alongside up to $110 million of concessional financing that was announced by the Australian government in April of last year. So of the total, we've got roughly 80% of the money already lined up courtesy of that partnership with the Australian government. The equity that we need to put into that project is one of the main uses of proceeds of the process that we're running through that you've talked about a couple of times in terms of us listing on the New York Stock Exchange.
You know, I'm really glad that you have the demonstration project because, I was joking with your PR team that typically when I hear about a new technology or someone who is going to reinvigorate this technology that either, you know, hasn't succeeded for a number of different reasons, the press release is always the first thing. And it's accompanied by some MOUs, memorandums of understanding, nothing contractual. And it's just this idea. Here's what we're going to do. It's going to solve the energy transition. We are going to address long duration storage, clean electricity, all of these different things. And there's nothing really of substance or reality to cling to. And that's what I really like about what you guys have done is that it's the opposite. I mean, you were working for years and years to solidify the technology, to get the process right, to prove that it works in the field, and then go to investors and say, we're ready to hit the public market, we're ready to scale, we're ready to enter new markets. How were you able to do that? Because this is one of those hard tech conversations where it's expensive to learn how to do new things, and it's expensive to scale anything that deals with like significant amounts of equipment and research and development. How could you do it?
Look, so John, we had extremely good fortune in the form of really two core backers that have allowed us to do what we've done by the provision of capital. So the earliest of those was an Australian high net worth investor by the name of Johnny Kalbetzer, who basically was friends with the founder of the business. He has been a significant source of funds for us and a very loyal investor for the first 13 years of our journey. About 10 years ago, we also started engaging seriously with the Australian Renewable Energy Agency, and ARENA has been, the other mainstay of the funding that we've received to allow us to progressively demonstrate and prove elements of the technology, and then obviously the demonstration plant, the 1.1 plant that I mentioned, megawatt plant that I mentioned earlier. So it's that capital that's allowed us to do what we're doing. I guess the other part of it is this is hard, right? So CSP. There's a graveyard of companies that have tried to do this stuff, and to your point, they've oftentimes gone out too early or gone out when the technology wasn't quite ready, and ultimately, because this is really challenging to execute, if you go too early and you haven't got it all right, then you end up in trouble. So we've had the I guess you'd call it the discipline as well as the funding to be able to sit quietly in our sheep paddock down here in Australia to perfect the technology before we appear and take on the world.
Well, when I was reading more about you, getting ready for this podcast, I was thinking a lot about the next generation geothermal push that's happening in the U.S. too. We interviewed the CEO and founder of Fervo Energy on our sister podcast, the Texas Power Podcast, about how challenging it is, even when we know that these assets have great attributes that we need on the grid to support this transition to intermittent renewables. The fundraising aspect of it and the policy structure that supports it is really, really tough to get through. And if you're not well capitalized and not well organized from within, you won't survive. So let's get to that next stage then. You're working on the utility scale project in Australia. When is it your hope that you are entering the US market with some tangible projects?
There's a couple of things that happen when you're building utility scale power station technology. The most important rate limiting factor is that if someone's going to buy a power station from you, they need to be able to visit a working power station. So the practical reality is we're not going to be starting construction until our Port Augusta project is operational. So the timing on that looks like FID at the end of this calendar year, 2023, and then really it's a 2-year build. So best case, we're looking at first energy end of 2024. end of 2025. So, you know, the hard answer to your question is that sort of time frame is when we'd be expecting to, you know, be putting up fences and swinging shovels in the US at the earliest. However, the other thing to bear in mind is that developing projects of this sort, depending on which jurisdiction you're in, can take anywhere between 2 to 4+ years. And so it's important that we get started in terms of US project development activities pretty much straight away. So I need to be careful what I say here, given I'm about to become listed on the New York Stock Exchange. But
we've had a lot of public companies on this podcast.
Watch this space for some announcements around how we're going to enter the US market. But it's clearly, you know, of all of the opportunities around the world, the US, because of the combination of sunshine, because of the combination of penetration that's already happened, particularly of PV on the in those sunny markets in the Southwest, and obviously because of the Inflation Reduction Act, you know, those three things coupled with the deep expertise and experience that a whole bunch of your professionals in the States already have with CSP make it a really logical next market for us to enter.
Yeah, maybe this is a good recruitment tool for you so you can make your pitch at the end to come work for VAST. Just a thought before we get to the policy structure, because that's an important part of this conversation. It just popped in my mind that this seems these kinds of high capex innovative projects are the perfect fit for like the loan programs office at DOE that is writing these $1 billion debt checks to help get off the ground, you know, long duration battery storage and green hydrogen. Is there a fit there maybe in the future? Is that something you've thought about as well?
Yeah, totally. And if you go back and look at some of the big CSP projects that were built in the US maybe a decade ago,
yeah,
similar arrangements were important in getting those projects going as well. So yeah, absolutely. The US has got a particular way of funding these sorts of technologies. Australia's got a different flavour of doing the same thing, and other markets do it different ways as well. But as you say, for projects of this sort, you know, high capital intensity, those sorts of loan schemes are important, particularly for the early projects. Obviously, once they become commercial, then all the banks pile in and it becomes much easier.
So this move was obviously in motion for you before the Inflation Reduction Act came on the scene last year and really changed this industry for the better overnight. But what does that mean for your entrant into the US? And what are some additional policy structures that we still need to get to make sure that CSP is something that works in our system and is rewarded properly? You know, how does that all need to come together? Because it is a major component.
Yeah, so you're right. We were already moving towards the US, moving towards the listing in New York before the Inflation Reduction Act. And certainly we've been eyeing the US as a potential market for many years. If you look at the economics of our technology, we expected it to be competitive, basically to clear the minimum price without the impact of the Inflation Reduction Act. What the IRA does is it just step changes down our economics by in the order of 25% of LCOE. So what that means is if we were clearing previously, what we were required to do in order to get a project done, then the economics become that much more compelling. And that just means we can either build more of them or we can do it faster or both, because there's just so much more demand for the product because the economics make that much more sense. In terms of the policy settings, you know, the IRA is massive. The federal department loan schemes are important. Frankly, I think those two are probably the main ingredients that are needed for there to be widespread deployment in the US of CSP. The other challenge is a physical one, right? It just takes a long time to build these plants. It takes a long time to do the permitting. So I think you will see on the back of those two initiatives, all of those projects start to fill up in the pipeline really quite quickly. There are certain other mechanisms that can be useful depending on particular circumstances. And the one that's in my mind is things like capacity payments. So, you know, if you're in an energy-only market, and I'll talk maybe in the Australian context, which is, I guess, kind of most similar to ERCOT, which I think is energy-only.
Yep, it is.
Some of the other regions are a bit more nuanced. But if you're in an energy-only market, what you tend to find is if you wait for there to be a need identified by an energy-only market for long-duration storage, what that means is you're going to have somewhere between 5 and 10 years of really high nighttime prices because, you know, for example, the coal's turned off and the gas has stepped in, but you want something renewable, that stuff takes a long time to build. And so energy-only markets, in our view, are limited in terms of the ability to drive more capacity into the market without the addition of some other signal. So in the context of the Aussie market, you've seen discussion for some time under both, you know, both types of government that we've had down here, Labor and Liberal. So I should say Labor and Coalition. You've seen moves towards the introduction of capacity mechanisms of some sort to try and actually pull forward the introduction of that long duration storage. So that's probably the only one, you know, if I was sitting in a room full of people from Washington that I'd be thinking about.
Well, it's actually similar to the transition that ERCOT is going through in the wake of Winter Storm Uri back in February 2021. They are going into a mix kind of market that does reward some capacity in a way. One of our bloggers, Doug Lewin at Renewable Energy World, qualifies it as, you know, the California capacity market by a different name, which is something that's a point of contention in Texas, and we don't need to litigate that here. But we are seeing that kind of change happening. And it's funny that you pick ERCOT as, you know, maybe the energy-only market wouldn't work for CSP or not be as favorable. The ERCOT market's probably the place that is best to build, though, also, right? Because of the space with land and the sun penetration and all those different things, I would assume.
Yeah, so certainly West Texas and that part up in the Northwest are both very favourable. As part of the work that Neighbours, our partner on the DSFAC, did with us, we spent a lot of time looking at that particular area and trying to figure out where we put plants, what the impact of the IRA would be, and it's attractive. I mentioned a moment ago, you know, our view was always that our technology needed to be below the clearing price if we were to get built. And, you know, one of those key due diligence activities that we did with the Neighbours guys was to demonstrate that in Texas, even in the absence of any sort of capacity payment. So, yep, we agree. Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, Nevada, California, they're all wide open for CSP.
Kind of alluded to it with the partner on the SPAC deal, but what's been the reception from maybe even some adjacent industries, oil and gas? How do they feel about what you're doing on the CSP side? Because we've seen a lot of, you know, kind of strange bedfellows, so to speak, with geothermal as well, like I alluded to, then seeing, you know, we have similar expertise, albeit applied differently. Have you gotten any support from those industries?
Yeah. So, John, maybe let me take your question in a slightly different direction.
Take it wherever you want.
And just talk about methanol for a moment, because if I talk about methanol, my comments about the support from industry will make more sense. So
okay.
One of the other projects, so we're doing three projects in Port Augusta. So the first one we've already spoken about, which is, we call it Var Solar One, which is a 30 megawatt CSP plant with 8 hours of thermal storage. So that's our utility scale reference plant. The second project we're doing is what we call Solar Methanol One, which is a green methanol production facility where we take water and we electrolyze it in a standard PEM electrolyzer. We're partnered with a company that does a point source CO2. So they actually have an electric calcining technology where they put in limestone, apply green electricity, they get lime out the bottom, which goes into cement manufacturing. And then we take the carbon dioxide and we take the carbon dioxide plus the hydrogen that we've created, merge that to create syngas. Then we create green methanol. And we ultimately are looking at using that as, you know, the offtake will most likely be into marine applications, because a lot of the shipping industry is moving to a dual fuel situation where they can burn either diesel or methanol. The interesting part about that methanol project is that at its core, it uses a couple of technologies that need a combination of both heat and electricity. If you think about most chemical refineries, where in essence what you're doing is messing around with the bonds between atoms, most refineries actually use a combination of heat and electricity. The heat, because it's really effective. I mentioned previously, if you've got heat, you can use it and it can be like 95% effective in terms of breaking up those chemical bonds. So what we're doing is using heat to do a bunch of the heavy lifting and then using less electricity to produce the green methanol. What that means is the green methanol we're producing is roughly 20 to 30% lower cost than if you were to try and do the same thing using electricity as the energy source alone. And that's pretty interesting, because if you look at the price that you're able to generate the methanol for once you're building it, you know, once you're generating it at scale, our numbers indicate that price is there or thereabouts with the current black price methanol. And that's really the first hydrogen derivative that we've ever looked at, where because of that combination of heat and electricity, we're able to produce a green product that's a similar price point to the black product. So look, that project is, as I mentioned, it's the second project we're doing in Port Augusta. It's co-located with VS1 necessarily, because it's hard to move heat. You need to connect the two plants with a pipe. And that project is basically being developed about 6 months behind VS1. The third project, just for completeness, is a straight vanilla 140 megawatt lithium ion battery project that we're doing basically as a way to make some money. You know, compared to the other stuff we do, it's pretty boring because it's just boxes with batteries in it. But everyone seems to want that down here at the moment.
Don't say that to the battery guys. So we've had a few of them on this podcast, so we don't want to disenfranchise them.
No, and look, you know, we don't diss the battery guys or the wind guys or the PV guys, because the reality is all of the technologies are needed. They've all got their role to play. But, you know, that technology is mature, so it's relatively straightforward to develop a project that deploys that technology and to make some money doing so, at least in the Aussie market at the moment. Coming back to your question, the methanol thing's interesting, right? And what we're finding is the oil and gas, you know, people that play with molecules, they like the methanol piece because it involves molecules. You know, if you're just talking about nighttime electricity generation, then that gets you so far. And there's a bunch of companies that, you know, that either need electricity now or who are looking to further electrify their operations, and that, you know, the nighttime piece becomes more important over time. But it's really quite a different conversation when you're able to deliver heat and electricity to a process that actually needs both of those ingredients in order for it to be economic. So we've had some really significant interest that's complementary to the interest that we've had on the electricity side, coming from, yeah, it's the oil and gas guys, but it's also the shipping companies I mentioned. Yeah, that's emerging as one of the preferred decarb pathways for the global shipping fleet. And then the other part that's interesting is that it's a pretty simple step to go from green methanol to SAF. That just uses technology that's been around for decades. So that's the other avenue that's emerging as interesting.
Excuse my ignorance, but when we're talking about green methanol, is that the same space as ammonia?
Yes, it is. Okay. And you're right on the edge of my technical competence here. But
We're far past the edge of my technical competence. So I'm treading water out here.
So if you're a pure hydrogen nerd, you would think that ammonia has a whole bunch of advantages that mean that it should ultimately be the thing that powers the global shipping fleet. However, if you're the guy who's buying boats for the global shipping fleet, right at the moment, you're looking down the barrel of decarb commitments in 2030 and 2050 that are going to be impacted by the asset that you're buying today that has a 25 to 35 year life. So you need to make decisions today that allow you to run those new boats in a, you know, a low carbon way. And the reality is methanol has some significant advantages, at least given where the technology is today. So number one, there's engines that burn it. Number two, it's a liquid at room temperature. So it's able to be installed in sort of existing physical infrastructure inside ships, you know, fuel tanks and things like that. And number three, the certification authorities appear to be more comfortable with methanol at this stage than they are with ammonia. And so that as I understand it, seems to be why people are buying, you know, dual fuel methanol boats, but they're not yet buying ammonia powered ships.
Let's round this out and get back to CSP and just put a bow on where you think this industry is heading, the trajectory, given this past that we've been through, and we know there have been some missteps or some challenges in deployment in various markets. How do you feel, given that you are bringing a somewhat new technology to market and really trying to bring back this industry that has had its set of challenges? Are you optimistic about where it's all heading?
Look, John, I am. You know, if you take a step back, we're starting to see significant decarbonisation in the electricity grid, driven by, you know, the switch from coal to gas initially, but then also the increasing penetration of PV, wind, and some batteries. That runs into a wall at somewhere between 20 and 40% to go. And you need different technologies. You need dispatchable, long-duration, renewable technologies. And really, you've got two choices. You've got either CSP if you're in the desert, or you've got pumped hydro if you're in Norway. So that's, you know, there's a fundamental need, and we don't see other technologies that are emerging that can hit the price point that we can in deserts. And so we're excited by that market opportunity. The other part of it is this emerging green fuels opportunity, which is just massive. You know, if you go and look at any integrated refinery around the world, they use a combination of heat and electricity to generate really low cost products. And that's what ultimately we think is going to be what transpires. And again, if you look at the fundamentals of the technology, our ability to generate very low cost heat at 550 Celsius that's dispatchable leaves us pretty well positioned. So am I excited? Yes, I am, because there's a massive need for what we do. I don't see other technologies that are able to do it at the price point, and that's exciting. Is it going to be hard? Absolutely. It's been ridiculously hard so far. And we don't expect it to be easy because, you know, delivering novel things, hardware's hard in a way that hits the price point, that hits the performance. You know, it takes precision, it takes great people, and it takes, you know, willpower, willingness and cooperation from partners, from financiers, from a whole ecosystem of people. So it's definitely challenging, but we've got to get on with it if we're going to actually decarbonize these hard to abate sectors.
Craig Wood, thanks for joining The Factor, this podcast. Great to see you.
Thanks so much, John.
Thanks again to Craig Wood for joining the podcast. Factor This is a production of Renewable Energy World and Clarion Energy. Join us every Monday as we break down solar's most important topics with industry leaders who actually move the needle. And please leave us a rating and review wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Factor This from Renewable Energy World.
Hey, it's John Engel, and I'm excited to share that registration is now live for Grid Tech Connect Forum California. Join us in Newport Beach, June 24th through the 26th for the Interconnection event. We're bringing together utilities, developers, regulators, and advocates to take on one of the biggest challenges facing the energy transition, both at the DG and utility scale levels. Click the link in the episode description and use promo code PODCAST to save 10% on admission. Join our partners from the Department of Energy, NREL, Southern California Edison, PG&E, CAISO, Sunrun, NG, Convergent, AES, and so many more for this impactful event. We'll see you there.